Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's the Sports Book Club with William Hill, where we take a look at some of the brilliant new sporting books that might hit your shelves and might just win the top prize. With me is the media man from William Hill, Neil Foggin. And on this episode, we're taking a look at Nicky Henderson, My Life in 12 Horses, written by Kate Johnson.
When you start talking to people who love horses about horses, something happens. And I can't quite explain it, but you see the most sweet, tender, loving, devoted side of someone. It's absolutely extraordinary.
And we'll speak to the legendary jockey, first jockey with Nicky Henderson for many years, Barry Geraghty.
What a brilliant ride from Barry Geraghty on Bobsworth. 5 from 5 from here, and that must seal the deal as far as the Trainers' Championship is concerned for Nicky Henderson.
That's for the fulfilment, that's the joy, that's the buzz, that's the excitement. That's where it all it comes from. And obviously, if you're lucky to get great horses like Bobsworth and Bouvedere and Sprinter Sacra and these, you can have some magic days.
I'm Adrian Durham. This is the Sports Book Club with William Hill. Nicky Henderson, My Life in 12 Horses with Kate Johnson, and delighted to have Kate Johnson with us on this show. Kate, how are you doing? First of all, congratulations on such an incredible book.
That's so kind of you. Thank you so much. I am delighted to be here. Thank you.
It's a masterpiece, really. I'm not overstating it. I am not a specialist horse racing reporter or even broadcaster. I've done a few meets and all that, the big ones. I'm not even a horse racing lover specifically, but this book got me fascinated, educated, interested, full of admiration for the sport and the people in the sport as well. So at the outset, was it a book designed to pay tribute to Nicky Henderson himself, one of the all-time great trainers? Or did you also see it as a chance to write something that was more significant and important for the reference libraries on horse racing as a sport as a whole?
Gosh, no, I didn't think anything like that. The idea just came to me, Nicky Henderson, My Life in 12 Horses. And as soon as I said it out loud, I thought, oh, I think that's a good idea. Everyone likes a list. It's got clear parameters. You know what it is. There's no boring bits. And so I rang him up and said, Nicky, I've had a great idea for a book. And he said, I'm at the sales. So can you keep it quite short? So I said what it was. And the very first thing he said was, oh, it's going to be very hard to narrow it down to 12. He didn't say yes and he didn't say no. And I thought, wow, he's in. By sheer sort of fluke, I found the way in. And so I just set out to talk to Nicky about his horses. I've always loved the way he talks about them. He's got, before anything else, he has an emotional connection to horses. They are in his bones. They are who he is. He could not be without them. And so I knew he would be best person to do this with. And then once we started talking, it just sort of took on a life of its own, really.
You did cheat, though. I mean, you said 12 horses. There's one chapter with 3 horses in. There's another horse at the end as well. You've cheated.
Well, you try and get him to narrow it down, because I certainly did. I kept saying, we kind of need to keep it to 12. And he was, I can't. And then I sort of said, by the time the book comes out, everybody's going to want to talk about Constitution Hill. And Nicky is very superstitious, and he absolutely flatly refused to have him as one of the 12. So we sort of sneaked him in at the end. But I did my best to keep it to 12. What can I tell you? He's a very persuasive man.
He is, yeah. And listen, with respect, I found it incredible that you did keep it to 12. But I think for the way the title scans, you can't go 15, can you? It's got to be My Life in 12 Horses.
Yeah.
My Life in 22 Horses just doesn't go, does it? Listen, there's a lot of things I want to get into with the book. It is about the whole sport. There's a bit on jockey injuries, which I find amazing. There's a good joke on that, actually. Letting jockeys decide when they're ready to return from injuries, like asking a Labrador to supervise the larder. So it makes you laugh, and as we're going to get into shortly, it also makes you cry as well. But it's beautifully written. It draws real emotions from the reader. I'm not sure, were you aware that that was going to happen when you were writing it?
Well, Nicky, as I say, is very emotional. But I was nervous about talking to the other racing pros, because Corky, for example, is a Lambourne legend. He was Nicky's head lad from day one up until the day he retired. He has a blue plaque at Seven Barrows. He is a legend. And he's fierce. He runs a really tight ship. And he told me a story about two stable lads who were late to work one day. And he gave them a rocket that would have smelted their stirrup irons. And 3 days later, they were late again. And he went upstairs, they lived on site, with two buckets of water, and threw a bucket over each of them in bed and said, either pack your bags and go, or get up and ride out. And they stayed. And they stayed for 6 years and rode out. And they said to him years later, when they met him at Newbury, thanks for that. We might have been in prison if not for you. So he's fierce, and I was nervous to talk to him. But when you start talking to people who love horses about horses, something happens, and I can't quite explain it, but you see the most sweet, tender, loving, devoted side of someone. It's absolutely extraordinary. And one of the horses that Corky mentioned was a horse called, I think, Kalini. I probably pronounced it wrong, but it was when Corky had first started working for Fred Winter, the legend of Lambourne, and this horse was going to be the English Arkle. He was already great, and he was set to be an era-defining horse. And he suffered a terrible injury at the races and had to be put to sleep. And Corky was completely undone by it and went home distraught. Fred came to see him that night and said, take as much time off as you want. Take a week, take a year, but don't give up on racing, because it's great and you're really good at it. And he did go back to work a few days later, and the horse's stable was bolted shut, top and bottom doors bolted shut, and they stayed bolted shut for weeks. And then they opened and another horse went in. And when Corky told me this, he was still, you could still see his pain, and it was 50-odd years ago. And so horses have a way of, they just get into you. They are a grand passion, and you cannot be half-hearted about them. And I think that's what comes out with everyone that I spoke to.
Well, Neil Foggin, you're obviously heading up the William Hill Reading Panel for the Sports Book of the Year. What was it about this book that said, yeah, this is going to make it onto the list, possibly?
We've had a few books about racing over the years, but this one is, for me, it's special. It's a bit like a love letter. It's a love letter to racing, and it's not, no disrespect to anybody or any book which has been before, it could quite easily be 12 horses and this is the horse, this is the weight, this is its record, blah blah blah. And it's not that. It's the relationship of this, of what people have with this horse, and the love comes through. And also, it's very well researched, and you've got parts of it where you learn stuff. I've worked for William Hill for 20 years, and horse racing is part of what we do. And this brings everything to life. Naively, I didn't know that the Fred Winter race at Cheltenham is named after Fred Winter, the legend. I didn't realise that. I didn't realise that Lanzarote was actually a horse. So it brought everything to life for me. And it's hearing the passion of these voices, of these people in racing, come through. And I think there's a bit at the beginning when you've got Michael Buckley talking on page 10. He says, it was a life somewhat divorced from reality, but owning a horse is based on dreams, which mostly are very far from reality. And I just thought, wow, it's great. It's a really good book, and I'm glad that it's been entered.
And Kate, you do get some extraordinary quotes from people. I mean, there's some beautiful quotes. How did you manage to get some of those? We learned that See You then had a ferocious temper. We learned that My Tent or Yours was, quote, quite a big, silly baby who couldn't organise himself. And the Long Run, riding Long Run, was like trying to contain a volcano. These fantastic imagery, but they've all come from people, either jockeys or whatever, within the industry. How did you get those quotes from people, get them to open up like that?
Well, I'm a horse lover myself, so I, you know, that's a sort of common language that unites us all, whether you're, you know, one thing that Sam Whaley-Cohen said, actually, that he was talking about lining up with Long Run for the Gold Cup. He was an amateur, you know, he was lining up with these ferocious pros, and Nicky had mentioned to me that when you're circling before a big race, as Nicky did in the Fox Hunters when he was an amateur jockey, it's the loneliest place to be. You've got no one to talk to. There are thousands, if not millions, of people watching all around the world. And you're on your own, and you know something massive is about to happen. And he said that was very lonely. And I said to Sam Whaley-Cohen, did you feel that? Were you lonely circling before the Gold Cup? And he said, no, I was with my horse. And there's just something really endearing about that. Whether you're 6 years old on a Shetland pony trying to get over a fence that's about 6 inches high and you can't, or whether you're Sam Whaley-Cohen lining up in the Gold Cup, there's a thread that unites us all. So maybe that helped to get people to talk that I'm also a horse lover.
Oh, there's a connection between jockey and horse, trainer and horse, stable lad and horse, owner and horse that really comes through in the book as well. And Neil, you talk about the education that you got. I'm exactly the same. For instance, I didn't know that Nicky Henderson's dad basically saved Cheltenham Racecourse. Otherwise, and we're speaking as Cheltenham Week starts on this podcast. And I never knew that. And suddenly, when that hits you early in the book, it's like, oh, okay, if you didn't know Nicky Henderson was a big player, all of a sudden now you do. If you're fresh to horse racing. There's other scientific stuff in there as well, Kate, that I'm super impressed with. Like, on page 41, there's suddenly some scientific research explaining how weight distribution can impact a horse's speed. And, that's not my skill set, so I had to read it a couple of times to try and understand it. You also talk there about a horse's associative memory. I learned so much. I learned what scoping is, and as I was reading what scoping is, Constitution Hill was being scoped. So all of a sudden, yeah, I could understand what was going on. I found it, Neil, like you, it was a real education in so many ways, scientific ways as well.
I think that's the beauty of this book. It's got about the horses, it's got the relationships, but you're also finding out, who would have thought, horses that should know how you're feeling. It makes sense, but when you read it at first, you're like, whatever, give over. But when you read it and you look at the research, you're like, I'm a fool for not knowing that. And it's just, yeah, it's a relationship, and it's a relationship when you hear Barry Geraghty talk about Constitution Hill and Sprinter Sacra, etc. And you've got AP talking about binocular. It's just fascinating. It changed my view. And if anybody, if the horse racing board or whoever wants to promote racing, this book does it.
It absolutely does.
This book,
does
you
that,
will
yeah.
fall in love with racing.
There's no doubt. I mean, my interest in Cheltenham has peaked because of this book. It's at an all-time high. There's, on the education side of it, there's a brilliant education on the biology of horses, Kate. And what happens, say, to the blood in a horse that makes them supreme racers. Also, the amount of weight going through one hoof as it hits the turf after jumping a fence. And all these things are mind-blowing in the numbers that you give out. Did this take a lot of time to research all this?
It did. It took about a year. I talked to about 60 people, not all obviously scientists, but across the whole book. And yes, I was fascinated too. When a horse jumps a fence, the non-leading front leg, the weight of a mini like goes through that non-leading front leg.
That's mind-blowing.
It's mind-blowing. And also, I mean, I'm not scientific, so I will explain it really badly, but when horses are doing really frenetic activity, all horses can do it, but really only racehorses need to, they can somehow collapse their spleen and get extra red blood cells when they need them into their blood. So they raise it from 40% to 60% of red blood cells when they need a shot, and then they return them to the spleen afterwards. They're absolutely staggering what they can do.
So it's doing what they used to do in the Tour de France, but legal. Isn't that amazing?
Yes. They're doping themselves, you're right.
There's also some... actually, Neil, you've got to make a confession here. Like me, did you cry at any moment when you read this book?
No, but I was on the edge.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you said you added that last bit, because...
yeah, I was on the edge.
Honestly, there's so many deep emotional moments in it. I'll give a few out. When Nicky has to have a horse put down, early in the book this is. Also, if you don't cry at the end of chapter 8 about Bobsworth, I honestly think there's something wrong with you if you didn't cry at the end of that chapter, Neil. Honestly, that must have been when you were on edge. I love that there's a love affair between Simon Sigg and Triola Delaney.
Yes.
Well, oh my goodness, which really hits the heart as well. The one that really got me though, and I took a right roller coaster of emotions with this, was when the chapter 4 about Remittance Man, okay? And this horse's relationship with a sheep called Nobby.
Yes.
And I didn't know this happened in horse racing, that horses have relationships with other animals, goats and sheep. And this horse, Remittance Man, brilliant horse, had this relationship with a sheep called Nobby, and they couldn't be separated. It's so beautifully written, and congratulations for that.
Thank you.
But at that stage when I was reading it, remarkably, because the first thing I ever do with a book that's got photos in is go to the photos, but at that stage, I'd been so gripped by the text, I hadn't looked at the photos. So I'm reading about Nobby the sheep and Remittance Man, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, there's got to be a photo of Nobby the sheep. If there's not a photo of them two together, I'm going to ask my money back on this book. Went straight to the photos, and there it is, a fantastic picture. It's got Ian Major, the stable lad, Remittance Man looking truly majestic, like the quality racehorse Remittance Man was, and staring at the camera under the body of this horse is Nobby the sheep. I don't think I've... So I was in tears reading about the relationship, and then I see the photo and I'm smiling more broadly than I've ever smiled at any photo in my life. It's absolutely beautiful.
It's so sweet, isn't it? And it was Nobby and only Nobby that would do. So Remittance Man is quite a good example, actually. For one thing, when Nicky bought him, nobody else wanted him. When he bought him at the sales, he certainly didn't stand out. He was scrawny, he was narrow, he was very unprepossessing, and Nicky's horses tend to have, as someone says, the look of eagles. And this horse had none of that, but he saw something. This is his stroke of genius. He saw something. He thought there might be something there. He liked the way the horse walked, and that's always a good sign. So he took a chance on him and then got him home and realised that he paced his box relentlessly, which is such a bad habit. You can send the horse back if you want to, because obviously he's wearing himself out all night. And so they tried various things. And Ian Major, who looked after him, was just so devoted to him. He talks in the book about how he would sit in his manger and sing to him. He would put a space hopper in the stable to try and distract him. And every night he would walk down to the stables with his dog at 10 o'clock and give the horse a carrot. And all the other horses were asleep. And every night Remittance Man was waiting for him to have his carrot, and then he'd settle down. So he was surrounded by great care, and they eventually got a sheep in for him, and the sheep would do a season like a debutant and then go back to the farm. Second sheep would come, and then Nobby arrived for the third season, and that was it. And it was only Nobby. And when they tried to introduce another sheep the next season, Remittance Man wasn't having it. He picked him up by his teeth and threw him over the stable door. Nicky said to his dad, "We're going to need Nobby back from his farm." And he said, "He's in that field with 399 other sheep." They hadn't marked him. They all looked the same. They didn't know what to do, but they knew they had to get Nobby. And so they rode a horse into the field. 399 sheep went one way, and Nobby appeared. And they were reunited. And they had a proper love affair. When Remittance Man was practicing on the gallops, Nobby would pace the yard waiting for him. They went everywhere together. He accompanied him to the races. And when they retired together. And the owners commissioned a bronze. Remittance Man was so successful. They loved him so much. They commissioned Philip Blacker to make a bronze of Remittance Man with Nobby. The two of them are in the bronze together. It's a proper love story.
It's a beautiful story. And actually, I think that goes beyond... If you're not really into horse racing, that story in itself goes beyond that. I think a lot of the stories do, to be honest with you. And when you talk about horses retiring, there are several descriptions of retired racehorses living out their days in fields all together. And I think that was an education to me as well, because I think some of us think, well, what happens to these horses after they can't race anymore? And they get well looked after. And Nicky Henderson, obviously... he finds homes for them or keeps them himself or takes them back.
Yeah.
There's a bit in it about JP McManus with a field full of horses. One field has 8 champion hurdlers in it, and Istabrak and Binocular are in there together. And I just, in my head at that moment, I stopped reading. I thought, I wonder what they talk about all day, which jockeys they liked and which race courses they thought were the best. But it conjures up so many images. And one other thing, Neil, I wonder if you did this as well. There were several moments in the book where you describe one of the horses winning a certain race, and I had to stop reading and go and watch that race. And I think it was Long Run when you described that winning the Gold Cup, I think, if memory serves me correct. And I stopped, watched it, and it was spine tingling. So I don't know if you did all of that.
No, I didn't do that, but it brought memories back of a lot of the race, especially Cheltenham. We're in Cheltenham Week this week, but yeah, it brought a lot of memories back. But when you're talking about the retired horses, on page 178, when we're talking about Sprinter Sacra, and we're talking about Vicky Roberts, who runs this retraining and rehab yard, and Nigel Twiston Davis, assistant trainer, has called her to say, "Can you take another horse? No, I'm full to the brim. I can't fit any more in. You'll like this one." "No, I won't. It's Sprinter Sacra." Next minute, she's taking it in, which is just... And I think that's... Yeah. You see, we see everything in this book, don't we? We see everything from Constitution Hill with Barry Geraghty and his family looking after this horse, for his daughter riding this horse and bringing it in like a pet, to what happens with on race day in the fields, to injury, to retirement, or unlucky in death and grief. And it's a fascinating book.
Now, you had to immerse yourself in all aspects of Seven Barrows, the stable, and all aspects of training horses for this book.
Yeah, well, I was really lucky. I spent loads of time with Nicky at Seven Barrows, and I stood at the top of the gallops and watched the horses coming up, which is just a beautiful sight from the bottom of the hill up and past you. I watched them schooling. I saw Nico de Boinville taking John Bond through his paces with Nicky watching and saying, "Far too fast, far too fast." I watched them going around the school kind of warming up when everyone walks past and says to Nicky the name of the horse they're on, and he tells every single one what they're doing that day, and it's different for every single one. You stay in the school, you go up the gallops with this one, you go on the round gallops, you go anti-clockwise here, you do this. I mean, it's extraordinary. And just to get a sense of what happens in a yard day to day is just, it's just so intriguing. I just want more of it.
I want to talk about Sprinter Sacra as well, because that must have been an important chapter, obviously. You talk about the pressure in that chapter on Nicky as a trainer. He calls it hell.
Yes.
The expectation of this horse winning everywhere he goes. The pressure on Barry to ride it to victory as well. And he didn't feel that pressure so much. But what about you? Was there pressure on you? Did you feel pressure to absolutely nail that chapter on such a horse?
Well, I know that Sprinter's comeback, 2016 comeback, when he retook the Champion Chase, was Nicky's finest day on a racecourse, finest race. And it meant so much to so many people. It was, so I was really aware that I had to get it right. And even when Sprinter was in his pomp, and as Nicky said, it was hell, all he could do was go wrong, and it didn't until it did. He found it hell, but the joy that horse brought to so many people is really emotional. I got goosebumps even thinking about it now. When Barry talked about taking the horse to Punchestown, and capacity crowd, the racing manager found someone wandering the car park the week before because he'd made a 300-mile round trip from Cork because he had to see this horse and he hadn't been before and he wanted to know the lie of the land so he didn't miss it. And the white rails bending in as people tried to get a glimpse of him. And he wasn't making punters any money. You know, there was no way you could make money. They just wanted the experience of wonder of watching this horse. And so I was really conscious of trying to get it right and trying to capture some of the emotion that goes into a horse like that.
Have you had any feedback from Nicky or anyone else regarding the book, and in particular that Sprinter Sacra chapter?
I've had a lot of people saying that they've been men being emotional. So,
and I don't know who you're talking about.
So I'm really glad to hear that, because, you know, sport is emotion, and I'm really glad to hear that men have been weepy.
I don't know if it's right that I felt most emotional about a sheep in a book full of horses.
Each to their own.
But that certainly was a beautiful moment. How proud are you of this book?
I'm really thrilled that so many people took part. I don't think there was anyone that I didn't speak to that I wanted to. I'm really thrilled. I mean, it's an honour to talk to all these people right at the top of the profession. Nicky, obviously, an absolute genius. But to talk, to spend time with talking to Barry Geraghty or AP, Nico, the grooms, the other trainers, the vets. I mean, it was just an enormous pleasure. And if it's sort of all come together, then that's good news. I mean, AP told me, I had a really soulful conversation with him, and he told me this, he misses it so much. Once horses are in you, you know, you've had it, and he misses racing so much. He told me, you know, with all due respect to the terrible injuries that racing sees every day. I mean, Sophie Henderson, Nicky's wife, said whenever she calls anyone who is riding at Seven Barrows, she has to call a relative. The first thing she says before she says hello is walking and talking, so that they know that their friend, wow, their partner, their husband is all right. And AP told, so it's mind-bogglingly dangerous. And AP told me that he misses all of it so much. He even misses falling in a 20-horse race and 20 horses galloping over him, lying on the ground thinking, am I going to live or die? And as the last heels disappear around the bend, he lies there and he thinks, I'm alive. And he said, that's an amazing feeling.
Well, it sounds like it, the way you've just described that. And Neil as well, I don't know about you, but I when I was reading about those jockey injuries, we mentioned them before, I was stunned, and there was a new level of admiration for what jockeys have to go through on the back of a horse or falling off the back of a horse.
Yeah, I've been lucky to listen to AP talk quite a lot about this in the past, and it's just what these people do for a living is they're literally putting their body on the line every day, and the dangers of that. And AP sometimes comes across quite blasé about it because it's happened so much to him. It's like, oh, it's just another bone, but it isn't. What they go through, it's unbelievable. But the beauty of this book is from Nicky, you don't just see Nicky the trainer, we see Nicky the human being. And I think we just see, like anybody in sport, you just see him as the role they're in. So you just see Nicky as a trainer or somebody as a football manager, etc., etc. Where here, you actually, the way that it's been written and the research, we see Nicky the man.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. And everybody, we've not just concentrated on Nicky and the jockeys and the horses. This book has got the vets, the stable lads, everybody involved. And I think that's the beauty of it.
Yeah, I do find it feels like it took years and years, because you've spoken to so many people and it's on so many subjects as well. But it also says to me that this is, the way you've written this book, it's not a biography of Nicky Henderson at all, but we find out enough about Nicky to not need a biography of Nicky Henderson.
Well, he said when we started this that he's always turned down every request to write his autobiography or to cooperate. He's not interested in that at all. But this was a way to find out about him, but through the horses, because there's no Nicky without horses, and it seems a really good way to find out about who he is and how he lives and what he does through these horses, his great loves.
You've done a remarkable job with it. You are a journalist, but this is, I believe, your first book.
Yeah.
Wow, that's not a bad debut. I read a lot of books, and often when I get to the end of a book, I think, God, I wish I'd written that. But at the end of this one, I thought, there's no way I could have written that. So for your first book, I'm absolutely blown away by
this. That's so kind of you. Now I feel emotional.
So when's the next one? And what's the next one about?
I do have some ideas, but nothing as yet.
Have you got the bug, though?
Well, yes. I mean, it's the horses, really. I mean, I'd love to do another book based on horses, because they are everything.
They are. On that, I think, Kate Johnson, thank you so much for joining us on this show. A truly incredible book. If you're not into horse racing, I do recommend that people read it, because it is something very, very special, and it'll make you laugh, it'll make you cry, it'll make you cheer along as they're winning that Gold Cup. It'll make you do so many things, feel so many feelings that you probably haven't felt for quite a while. It's brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I belong with you, you belong with me, my sweetheart.
As they come now to the next fence, Sprinter Sacra just sweetly jumps it. Evidently, Barry Geraghty has got time to look over his shoulder. He shouldn't be doing that in this race. Comes now to the final fence, booted into it. This is just effortless. This is just classy. This is just extraordinary. Sprinter Sacra has made mincemeat of the opposition. It's Sprinter Sacra. What a performance. This is an equine superstar. Brilliant winner of the Queen Mother Champion Chase. From seemingly out of it, he's now swept to the front as they come to the final race. What a perfect ride so far. Nicky Henderson and Barry Geraghty, 4 from 4 at Cheltenham. Can they make it 5 from 5? But this isn't the moment, Bobsworth. Here comes Turner Shop. He's really been driven out by Tony McCoy. He's a length and a half down, but he's not going to get there. What a brilliant ride from Barry Geraghty on Bobsworth. 5 from 5 from here, and that must seal the deal as far as the Trainers' Championship is concerned for Nicky Henderson.
That was Barry Geraghty winning the 2013 Gold Cup at Cheltenham on Bobsworth for Nicky Henderson. And on this episode of the Sports Book Club, we're focusing on Kate Johnson's wonderful book about one of the greatest racehorse trainers. It's called Nicky Henderson, My Life in 12 Horses. You think of Nicky Henderson, you think of a number of incredible horses, and you also think of certain jockeys as well. Barry Geraghty is one of them. He was first jockey at Seven Barrows for many years, riding Bouverdaire, Simon Sigg, Sprinter Sacra, Bobsworth, many, many others, and many of them winners as well. It was a privilege to speak to Barry for this edition of the Sports Book Club, and I started by asking him about Bobsworth, a horse that won 3 different races at 3 consecutive festivals, but it's the way the book gives more time to the emotions and love between humans and horses that had me gripped when I read it. I'll quote Barry's words when describing Bobsworth. He calls him, quote, kind-natured individual, living the life he deserved. It's clear this horse meant a lot to Barry and to everyone at Seven Barrows and beyond.
Absolutely. He was a gorgeous horse. I was lucky enough to have bought him as a foal with my brother, and Nicky bought him off us as a 4-year-old. He was a nice, sweet horse, but we never expect him to go on to achieve all he did. But just a lovely nature, lovely temperament. I always described him as unassuming. And he was unassuming in personality, but also in a race, that he would creep away quietly, and then he would come with this devastating speed late on. But you'd never know he was in the race. The commentator would barely recognize him. He wasn't overly big. So in stature, he wouldn't stand out, but he wouldn't stand out in presence either.
So Bobsworth is chapter 8 in the book. I'm not going to reveal, no spoilers here, I'm not going to reveal the details of what happens. I mean, most people will know anyway, but at the end of that chapter, you and Nikki shed a tear. I don't mind saying I'm no horseman, but I do love animals. I absolutely shed a tear as well. And I would defy anyone to read that chapter, the way it's written and everything that happens, Barry, and not at least have a lump in their throat. It brings out genuine emotions in any human being.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so we won't go for the spoiler, but yeah, no, a tough finish to a beautiful story. And he was such a gorgeous horse, as I say, and everyone adored him. And he had a beautiful life in retirement with the two Vigor boys, and they were loving him too. And he has kids, I think about 12 and 13. So yeah, he was a really, really special horse, but mostly for his personality, and his achievements were nearly secondary.
And I think that when you mention the life that the horse had after racing, I think this is one of the things where you really begin to build a huge amount of respect for Nicky Henderson, because, I mean, he takes some of the horses on, takes some of them back if you know they can't be looked after they've left the yard. And there's a real care, aftercare for the horses once their racing career is finished.
Absolutely, yeah. But that's horse people in general. You know, it's if you work with animals, and animals are to be at their best, they need to be cared for. So your natural way is to care for that animal. It's like having a dog. If you're a dog person or a cat person, you care for them. And, you know, you enjoy a horse's racing career, but it's natural to want to care for them afterwards. And we're blessed in racing with the level of retirement homes now, people taking race horses, you know, to use them for regular show classes and hunting. And, you know, they have a life after racing, just as a hobby horse. And Bobsett was the perfect example. He had the most amazing retirement.
In the section on Bouverdere, Nicky talks about the horse being a great friend. And I must admit, that took me by surprise that he talks about a horse like that. You talk about beating Mellon in the Champions Hurdle. You talk about knowing a horse well, knowing the feel you get back from the horse. You say you need to understand them to know when the green light comes on, when it's time to go. And again, that relationship between jockey and horse, it's so beautiful, Barry. But also, how important is it when it comes to being a winner?
Well, it's understanding. And I suppose it's the same in athletics, if you like, or any racing sport, where it's, you know, be it cycling, where you have to judge your pace, time your challenge, but you need to understand. A runner knows when their best time to kick is, but a jockey needs to understand this horse, and you need to have a connection to know when is the time. You know, you've judged the pace through the race. If they've gone fast or they've gone slow, you have to make the decision based on the knowledge of your horse, the conditions on the day, the track, how big a test of stamina it is, your opposition. There's so many things to weigh up in that moment. But a lot of it's done on instinct. And the instinct goes back to the connection with the horse and understanding the horse and understanding what's going to serve them best.
I also think that there's a lot about the horses, obviously, that the book is, you know, on the title, it's 12 horses. There's actually more than 12, but we'll talk about that in a second. But I think that one of the things that surprised me is the level of detail on various different aspects connected to racing horses. And one aspect I'd love you to talk about is the injuries that jockeys sustain. And not just that, the fact that they've got injuries, which most of us would be laid up for weeks. You've got injuries, and yet the next thing you want to do the next day or that day is get out on a horse, even though any doctor in the world would say, no, you've got to rest for about 6 weeks. I mean, you lot are absolutely mad.
Yeah, I suppose it's something you're just conditioned with. And when I think back to my own early days, when I was, you know, 17, I had my first fracture as a jockey. I broke my collarbone. I was out for 3 weeks, I think, but I tried to get back after two. And it just becomes your way that you're trying to fast forward the healing process as much as you can. You're pushing the boundaries because you want to get back in the saddle. It just continues that way through your career. And I suppose probably the worst fracture I had was in my final year when I broke my leg badly and had an external frame fitted. I had that for 14 weeks and I was trying to get back after 4 months, and the doctor was laughing at me, you know, said no chance, and I'm trying to get back at 5, but I eventually got back at 6, and the recovery time was actually good considering the fracture I had. But you're constantly pushing the boundaries to get back. And it's kind of how the wear and works, if you like. And that's, it's a different sport insofar as you can ride with a, like I rode winners with a broken wrist, for example. I've ridden with broken ribs, as have lots of other riders. But you are guiding the horse and helping the horse. You're not the one who is putting in the performance as such. So you can get through a day carrying an injury once you don't fall on that injury, if you like. So it's very different like that. But yeah, it's just becomes a way of life, I suppose.
And how exhilarating is it? Because when I read about, it goes into a lot about physics and the amount of weight going through one leg of a horse, one hoof of a horse, when the horse lands after a jump. I mean, the balance of exhilaration that you're feeling as a jockey on board that horse, knowing that there's so much weight going through that landing foot, but also the fear, I guess, that you might have that any moment, any just slight, if there's a stone on the track or whatever, something could go wrong. So what's the balance of exhilaration and fear there?
I would say complete exhilaration. And if there's fear, it's limited. If there is fear, you're probably in the wrong job. But I suppose it's all relative. If you love riding motorbikes at speed, you don't feel the fear, and the fear is probably where the adrenaline comes from. So you're like that. You're living on the edge. So as a jockey, you're living on the edge, but you're also in your comfort zone. It's where you're happy. If you're playing rugby and you're stuck in the middle of a ruck or a scrum, that's not the place I'd want to be anyway. But if you're a rugby player, you will be happy there, and that's where you will thrive. So as a horse person who wanted to be a jockey, I was in my comfort zone at that speed, living on the edge. And that's where the fulfillment, that's the joy, that's the buzz, that's the excitement. That's where it all comes from. And obviously, if you're lucky to get great horses like Bobsworth and Bouvedere and Sprinter Sacra and these, you can have some magic days.
You've gone there. I can't hold back any longer. Sprinter Sacra, your opening words in the book about this horse, legend of a horse, are, quote, "He was gorgeous and amazing." And actually, I read that and I had to read it again. I thought, wow, it's an amazing way to describe your animal. And looking back on it now, how would you describe your relationship with Sprinter Sacra?
Yeah, amazing. He is the most gorgeous horse. And I was very lucky to sit on him only recently. So I got to ride him for the first time in 9 years, only last week. And he is still as gorgeous as he was. He's been cared for so brilliantly. And looks amazing, but he's the same energy, he's the same enthusiasm, you know, he's still a handful, in an exciting way. He's not that he's making life difficult for you, but he wants to get on, he wants to please, he's eager, he's forward, he's got speed. But when riding him as a younger horse, and riding him over fences especially, I never got the feeling of any horse that I got off him. He could just pick up at a fence and touch down on the far side. He would make lengths in the air, but just the ease he did at the grace, but he was all energy. He was all enthusiasm as well. But I like that as well, a kind natured horse. He wasn't physically strong that he was pulling your arms off. He was keen to get involved, keen to go forward. He wanted to please. He loved his race, and he was a ball of energy.
I just gasped a little bit when you said that you sat on him for the first time in 9 years. I mean, what? Just how did that feel? What were your emotions?
I didn't know what to think, really, because it had been so long, and you're expecting. So he's 18, I think it is. You're expecting to meet a slower, more laid back version of Sprinter Sacra, but it wasn't. He could have been him again as a 4 or 5 year old. He was full of life. And it was back in Seven Barrows where this happened. I'd say for him to come back to that environment. So we went for a walk out past the schooling fences. So the fence you would teach your horses at home. And he didn't know what way to turn. He was I won't say losing himself, but he was so excited about it. So like it was a real thrill for both me and him. And then to go up the gallop with him, the gallop that he was training on for years. And you could feel it, like he was back home. And, you know, I was obviously mindful that he's not in training, so I was keeping him as steady as possible. Yeah, you could just feel that, the energy, but it's just the grace and the presence. And yeah, he just strut around the place. He was an amazing horse. He was no doubt, he's one of a kind. You know, he was the closest thing to perfection you could ever get in a racehorse.
I think one of the joys of the book is how Kate Johnson has managed to get some wonderful words from the many people she interviewed. You were among those, obviously. And I'll just read this passage in the book. This is you describing Sprinter Sacker. Quote, he had so much enthusiasm. I never rode a horse that left the ground and touched down the far side the way he did. He was so precise. Don't think he ever made a mistake. That's a lot of love you've got for this horse, Barry. And I'm picturing with how you're describing sitting on him and how excited he was, I'm thinking, wow, are they making a comeback at Cheltenham this year? Both of them would be, the crowds would flock, no doubt about it. But I mean, that connection between you and the horse, you clearly still felt it when you sat on him this time around as well.
Oh, I did. I really did. And yeah, just the emotion. It was I didn't know, as I said, I didn't know what to expect going there. But as soon as he stepped off the horse box, I was just like, wow, you are amazing. And then just to be with him. And, you know, as I say, he's a kind natured horse, but he's enthusiastic. He's got energy. He's got this presence. But it's a graceful presence that oozes class. Yeah, he's a very special horse. And you wouldn't even get to think about memories at the time. You just enjoy him and embrace him. And yeah, I had a lovely couple of hours with Sprinter, and it was a real joy.
That's fantastic. The way you talk about this horse makes me want to take him out for a pint. It's just the best horse ever. For some time, Sprinter Sacra was unbeatable. You know that. And Nicky describes that as hell for him because all the expectations that came with it, the public were coming along, they were paying money to see this horse win. So did you feel that pressure when sitting on him and racing?
I didn't. I felt more privileged, and I probably trusted it. It's probably easier for a jockey in the moment because you can, when the race starts, you can influence the situation. But the trainer or the owner or the stable lad are in the stands watching. It's out of their control. So you're in the moment, you're making the decisions. So the albeit the book stops with you, but you're sitting on this amazing horse. You would have to do something desperately wrong for him to get beaten. But as a rider, you're working off experience, and you trust yourself, your own decision-making in the moment, that you are 99% certain or 95% certain to make the right decision. So you have a plan. You stick to it as much as needs be, but plans can change, but you know that you'll make the right decision. You understand your horse. We spoke about Bouvardaire and timing. It's that connection. So it's just being able to be in the moment, get into flow, trust your horse, understand your horse, and ride the race that's going to suit him for him to be at his best. Where if you bring external pressure into that moment, that will cloud your judgment. So you need to be clear of mind and trust yourself, trust your horse. I suppose above anything, believe.
The passage in the book that describes, and again, it's another tear-jerking moment, and there's several of them in the book, but the passage that describes how you made the decision to pull up Sprinter Sacker at Kempton December 2013, deeply emotional. It's gripping as well. That's one of those where I'm carrying on reading. I don't care what's going on. I wouldn't have wanted to have been in your silks that day. How easy was it to take that emotion out of the situation, pull up the horse, do the right thing for the horse, knowing that, you know, there might be questions asked elsewhere and afterwards? How easy or difficult was that?
Oh, to me, it was just instinctive. It was on reflection, going to the start, he was a little quieter than normal. And I probably, albeit I recognised it, but I didn't consider what it could lead to. So he was quiet going to the start, and then he was quiet early on through the race. And I'm sorry, this is a bit strange. And you're taking stock of all these moments. But when I asked him for a big jump, I went looking for a big jump at the fence before I pulled him up. And I knew, so I'm about four strides away, and I started to give him a little squeeze. Now, I shouldn't have to squeeze him. All I have to do is just give him not even an inch of rein, you know, like a fraction of rein, and boom, he's gone. He extends his stride and he takes you to the fence. But I actually had to go and give him a little squeeze, and the response wasn't there. So I gave him a squeeze four strides away, three strides away, and the response wasn't coming. So I knew at that moment, before I jumped the fence, I said, that's it, we're done. And pulling you up, something was amiss. I didn't know what it was, but I needed to get him stopped and get him home. And you know, that's your instinct, that's your intuition kicks in as regards your level of care. So you talk about horsemanship and retirement and the natural want to care for a horse. That's just the moment. And whether that was Sprinter Sacra, or that was a horse at home in the gallops, or that was a pony when you're a kid, you just know that decision, know that something's right. Whatever it was, this horse is better off if he stopped and we can check him out. So it was purely instinctive. But I suppose the most comforting thing for me was knowing I was coming back to meet Nicky, and Nicky wasn't for a second going to guess me or second guess me as regards my decision making. He had complete trust in me. He knew I pulled the horse up for the right reason. And in the moment, the horse actually was reasonably fine. I trotted him back. I didn't dismount him. I couldn't tell what was wrong, but he was a flat battery is how I described it. But never once did Nicky say to me, "Are you sure you did the right thing?" He knew I wasn't getting the vibe that I should get. So that was what made it easy, I suppose.
So there's a lot about Nicky and him trusting your expertise on that. And turned out to be a regular heartbeat. And then the Sprinter Sacra comeback is an incredible story. You obviously weren't on board for that comeback story. And I have to say, your quotes in the book about the comeback, they're very warm, they're very generous. I think there might be some people who, you know, they might be bitter about it. But when I read it, it felt to me like you were genuinely happy someone else had enjoyed such a wonderful moment with such an incredible horse. Is that how it was?
Oh, really? Definitely was. Because Nico had done so much early work on Sprinter. So I was first jockey to Nicky for 8 years. And then I took up a role as first jockey to JP McManus, which offered me, I suppose, more opportunity in Ireland, which was what I was, you know, really longing for. So Nico stepped into the position as first jockey for Nicky. Albeit Sprinter had made a comeback, he hadn't got back to anywhere near the level he was, and he looked like as if he was a shadow of his former self. But that first season when Nico was first jockey and I'd taken up the role with JP McManus, Sprinter started to come back to life. So I'm watching on from the sidelines, but this is the horse I adored. You know, I wanted to see him do what he did and achieve. I'd love to have been on him, don't get me wrong. But I wasn't looking at him in any way begrudgingly, because I was thrilled for him, the horse, to see him back, thrilled for Nicky, thrilled for Nico, Caroline Mole, his owner. We had so many brilliant days. You couldn't but be happy. And to see the scenes in Cheltenham when he won the Champion Chase, it was magic. So no, you have to, you know, it's what racing's about. It was beautiful. Just to see him get back to where he was, you know, it was really special.
One question I was going to ask, I still will ask it. I think I know the answer. What's your favourite Nicky Henderson horse and why?
Oh, we probably discussed two of them already, was Bobsworth and Sprinter Sacra. And probably for the completely opposite reasons. One was Sprinter being all flash and presence and exuberance and achieved so much. And then Bobsworth being the opposite, not very flashy, not much presence, but then achieved so much as well. So they were two special horses, two amazing horses. But there were so many as well. Simon Sieg was a brilliant horse. Bouvedere likewise, Epitant, you know. So lots of spoiled for choice.
Seven Barrows and the whole Nicky Henderson setup seems very special. Can you explain what it is, in brief really, that makes it so special?
It goes back to the level of care, horsemanship, be it through Nicky, but it feeds from Nicky through into the staff. Charlie Moorlock as head lad, the assistant trainers he's had over the years, Tom Simmons, Ben Pauling, Charlie Longsdale, you know, Jamie Snowden. It's all, you know, you don't clock in 9 to 5 or anything close to it. Those guys are in work at 5, 6 in the morning. And they don't leave the yard till 6 would probably be standard, or 5:30, but it could be 7 or 8 before they're gone, because they could be treating a horse who's got an ailment. So it's a labour of love, and it's that commitment. But it's the same for so many yards across England and Ireland. It's that level of commitment to your horse and the care. It's natural then, if you're going to do an extra hour at work because you're caring for a horse, you don't even look at your watch. So it's that, that's where it comes from. It's knowing your horse, understanding your horse, but just the level of care that they thrive on.
The title of the book is My Life in 12 Horses. Kate Johnson's been a bit sneaky. She's put 3 horses in one of the 12 chapters, Binocular, My Tent or Yours, and Bouvedere, all in the same chapter. Are you surprised, though, that she managed to whittle it down to that number of horses? Because there were plenty more as well.
Oh, there was, definitely was. But yeah, I was wondering what way she was going to do us 12. And then when she squeezed in the 3 together, which made sense. Because My Tent or Yours, albeit he never won a champion hurdle, he was a brilliant horse. I was second on him at champion hurdle. I beat him in a champion hurdle when I won it on Jeski. Yeah, you know, he was second in a supreme novice hurdle. He was a brilliant horse. Likewise, Bouvedere, the same, and Epitant too, both champion hurdle winners. So yeah, it was a good way to sneak in a couple of extras, because I was wondering what way she was going to do it.
Yeah, My Tent or Yours, just very briefly on this, I think that this horse sounded like a proper character.
Yeah. I'd say I never rode a horse that pulled as hard. So I spoke with Sprinter Sakura. You know, he was energetic and enthusiastic, but he wouldn't actually pull as hard as you might think to watch him. My Ten to Yours, my God, he took some, as you'd say, some grip. He would constantly pull and pull and pull, which was, you know, burning energy in the process, but he was a relentless galloper as well. So he was a really good horse. He had a massive, massive engine, a massive heart as well. I got a great trail on him when I was second on him in the Champion Hurdle to Annie Power. And I thought for a second at the top of the hill, we might win. But this was his first run back for over a year, I think it was. And like that, Nicky, to get him in that level of form and as fit as he was for his first run back after such an absence was brilliant. But no, he was jumping as well. It was amazing. I remember winning the international hurdle race. It used to be around just before the meeting in December. It's now switched to trials there. I'd gone to the last hurdle and there was three of us upsides and just fired him at the last. It was all the chips were in. And so for both of us, and he came up trumps. He just dived at the hurdle, landed running, battled and won the race. And I think it was his only success at Cheltenham. But it was a great moment. But he was brave. He was particularly brave that day at the last.
There's a lovely little quote I'll give you from the book about My Ten to Yours. It's, he was a big, silly baby who couldn't organise himself. It just makes me laugh. Sounds like me. Fantastic. There's a little postscript and afterword in the book about Constitution Hill, a horse I believe you co-owned. You've always believed in this horse, even early on when Nicky Henderson had some serious doubts. After what's happened, and obviously he's out of Cheltenham, the Cheltenham Festival, how confident are you this horse will be back?
Well, he's missed it for, you know, which is great, a simple reason, if you like. You know, he's got a bit of a lung infection, if you want, which is the timing. It's just that's the real pity. But no, he's bounced back. It's nothing serious. So yeah, it's just a pity he's going to miss Cheltenham. But he was such a pet here at home that all my kids, three kids at the time, they all rode him, which is very unusual for a three-year-old racehorse to be ridden by a five-year-old boy, a nine-year-old girl, and a 15-year-old girl. But he was so quiet. The kids were mad to have a go on him. And like that, I've been loving this fella since he was a foal. So they're feeling it off me that dad thinks this fella's special, if you want. And but he's so quiet, they wanted to have a go. So it was a beautiful thing for them to all experience. And then to have them there for him to win his Supreme 2 seasons ago, that was amazing. So I've obviously been blessed with great days in Cheltenham and they've been watching on. But for my wife and my kids to be so involved in the winner's enclosure that day and the same at the Champion Hurdle last year, it was brilliant. But he's a bit like Bob's horse, he's a little bit unassuming. Once he gets into gear, he's a lethal weapon. And Nicky was... he was questioning it to me when he had him at home before he got into serious work. He said, this fella's, he's holding everything up. He's in getting in everything's way, if you want. And I said, Nicky, when you get this fella on the gallop and you give him a little squeeze, you'll know then what I mean. So he soon got to see the response for Constitution Hill when you press the button, because it's pretty exciting.
You're still as excited for Cheltenham, even without the hill?
Excited for Cheltenham, but I suppose it doesn't have the same potential as it did have the last couple of seasons. But no, Cheltenham is massive and I'm really looking forward to it. I suppose we were let down gently with Constitution Hill. I was at Kempton that morning for his gallop and was there as he disappointed. So, you know, straight away there's a question mark over Cheltenham. So I suppose we had a week to digest it before the news finally was confirmed. That's a real pity, but it's a minor issue. It's nothing major. So, you know, it's not, you know, a career-ending injury would be much, much worse. So you have to be realistic, I suppose. So we look forward to seeing him either at Punchestown or at Aintree, maybe. I look forward to him in the future.
And just one final one on Cheltenham, and you're obviously a Cheltenham legend. The amount of races you've won there is just phenomenal. And when you're there observing, what do you think it is about the festival that makes it so magic?
Oh, it's just got a bit of everything, you know, like the National Hunt Racing, you know, if that's your sport, it's you know, if rugby's your sport or soccer or Gaelic football or whatever it is, whatever excites you, like National Hunt Racing is spine tingling for me to be in the stands watching a Gold Cup or a Champion Hurdle, and the energy and the buzz at Cheltenham, and it's such an amphitheatre as well. The winner's enclosure, it's the stakes are so high. Everyone wants to win at Cheltenham. You know, your season is judged by Cheltenham. So it is a magic place. And yeah, to go back and back again for 4 days, it's brilliant and I can't wait. But I suppose it the English-Irish rivalry, it's gone the other way. It was very dominant with the English for years. It's dominant now with Ireland, but I'm sure it'll swing back again in time. There's just so many layers to it, but above everything else, it's just, you know, it's the raw emotion and excitement of national hunt racing. And it's just thrilling.
Barry, it's been such a pleasure to speak to you. Really, I've taken up so much of your time, but it's been a proper education. Thank you so much.
Cheers, Adrian. Thank you.
Kate Johnson's book describes Barry Geraghty as a man who was practically born as the big occasion jockey. And what a good talker he is as well. Really enjoyed speaking with Barry Geraghty about Kate Johnson's book, Nicky Henderson, My Life in 12 Horses. And Neil Foggin from William Hill, it is a contender. There's no doubt about that. It's just a brilliantly written book and a fantastic book to read.
Yeah. And it'll be difficult. It'll be in that conversation at the end of the year when we're discussing what will make that long list. I think it's definitely up there at the moment. And to be honest with you, we're off to a flyer at the moment. Touch wood, I think we're in a great position. We've had the most books we've ever had at this position. So I think the message of getting your books in early is getting through. But please keep them coming in. We've got Easter coming up. We need something to do over that Easter holiday, so get your books in. But again, we've had some interesting subjects in so far. We've had a book about climate change, which in my history in the award, it's only been a few years, and I was talking to Graham, the founder. We don't think a book has been entered about climate change
important
in sport.
Subject as well,
so
yeah.
for there to be one, that would be interesting to read. That book doesn't come out in May, but has already been entered. So it shows you that people are listening to us.
So you don't even have to have had the book published yet to enter it.
As they've sent us a copy of the book, and it's just under embargo. But yeah, they've sent it in early. We've last 2 years it's happened. We had a LeBron James book last year, which came in early, and Hard Parts. It was another one which was sent to us 3 weeks before publication date. So yeah, you can get them in early, and it works this time of year because we've got time to read these books. We've had 3 books about athletics. Again, we find that happens after the year before winner. You find that whatever has won that, you tend to get a flurry of those sort of books. I think it just jogs people's memory. Mm. So look, if that's won, I could win this prize. We've had a book about cricket and baseball, named Baseball. Formula One, which is timing with the launch of the new season. And we've had a book about boxing, which is the title Death of a Boxer. So let's see what that one's about. But yeah, I think we're in a really good position. Some good reads to get stuck into over the next few weeks.
Well, I love reading a book, so make sure you send them to me and I'll be getting all of those read. And the great thing from my point of view is I don't have to make the judgment call on it, so I just get to read them.
Thanks for that. But yeah, we've had our first, what we call book club. So we had our first meeting where we discussed the first 12 entries. So we are up and running. We'll have our next one in about 4 or 5 weeks. But yeah, we are up and running with some, I think, so far some strong contenders.
Neil Foggin, great to speak to you as ever. We'll do this all again on the next one, yeah?
Yes, we will.
I look forward to it. The Sports Book Club on TalkSport 2 with William Hill.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.